We know that from quasar statistics that quasars used to be much more common in the past than they are today. The expectations, therefore, is that we should be finding many dead quasars in nearby galaxies, as Doug has described. And one method to do that is using kinematic measurements of nearby galaxies. What I'd like to do is describe an alternative method, which is a more efficient, a more wholesale method of trying to locate these dead quasars. Because they're not exactly completely dead. I mean, they're certainly much less luminous than in the past during the quasar era, but there is likely to be residual emission that you can detect if you look very, very hard. Okay? So that's the focus of my talk, is to try to describe this population of objects, the most nearby AGNs we can possibly find. I will focus on three broad topics. The first is I'll summarize the current status of affairs for statistics of emission line galaxies based on surveys of the nearby universe. And then I'll spend a lot of time discussing the physical properties of these objects, because I think I have to do a very hard job to try to convince you that these things have anything to do with the AGN phenomenon. Because if they don't, then I should go home. I should not be here. I'll try to convince you that they indeed are fundamentally powered by black holes, specifically massive black holes accreting at a very low rate. And you will see that there are basically two broad conclusions one can draw. The first is that it appears that massive black holes indeed are present probably in all galaxies having bulges, and possibly even some without bulges. And secondly, most of the lifetime of these black holes is spent in quiescent. Okay, they're lying low, so to speak. And this has a number of important implications, not only for black hole studies and AGN studies, but also for galaxy evolution and some larger issues, which I'll touch upon. I would be remiss if I didn't acknowledge the help of a number of people I received in the various projects I'll be describing. The original group was really simple. It only had three people. My thesis advisors, Alex Filipenko and Mal Sargent, from which all the subsequent work was motivated. But since I left Berkeley 3 years ago, I've expanded the program to a number of other wavelengths and other directions, and that required enlisting the help of a number of people listed here, for whom I'm very thankful. Let me now describe the optical survey that I alluded to. Using optical spectroscopy is the most efficient way to look for weak nuclear activity in nearby galaxies. A number of people have done this some 15 to 20 years ago, beginning the thesis work of Tim Heckman and Bill Keel and John Stauffer. And the general consensus at the time was that it appears that the fraction of galaxies which have weakly active nuclei is very, very large, much larger than you would imagine from, you know, say, the Markarian survey of Cepheids, or certainly for quasars. Alex Filipenko and Wal Sargent set out to refine this statement and put it on a quantitative level a number of years ago. In fact, I was still in high school at the time. Their goal was very, very ambitious, okay? They wanted to essentially survey every bright galaxy in the northern hemisphere with the largest telescope available at the time, which is the 5-meter at Palomar. The goal was to obtain exquisite quality spectra at moderate resolution that you can measure every last weak line, okay? This project turned out to be very laborious. It took about a decade to finish, the last half of which became my thesis. It contains about 500 galaxies brighter than B magnitude of 12.5. And this is a distribution of Hubble types, and you can see it's a very good representation of the general galaxy population. It's essentially a snapshot of the Shapley-Ames. Good number of galaxies per Hubble type bin, equal number of bars versus non-bars. So very good statistics on the general galaxy population. Now, since I realize most of the audience is not familiar with optical spectroscopy, forgive me if I belabor a little bit of basic introduction so that we're on equal footing. The technique that I use to classify galaxies as active or not is based exclusively on the relative line ratios of the narrow optical lines. Okay? And let me briefly explain how this works. In the optical regime, the most prominent lines you can see are the recombination lines of hydrogen, H-alpha, and the forbidden transitions of oxygen, nitrogen, and sulfur, at least in the red part of the spectrum. And you notice a very striking trend if you compare the two objects in the top versus the object in the bottom. The two objects in the top are respectively Cepheid galaxy and what's called a liner, which is simply a lower ionization version of Cepheid galaxies. But the hypothesis at the moment is these are powered by AGNs, and this is the object in the bottom is powered by normal OB stars, and you can see immediately that the forbidden lines relative to, say, H alpha is extremely much stronger compared to the starburst galaxy. And the reason is very simple. You see, these forbidden lines are collisionally excited lines. Okay, you require hot electrons to coexist along with these species, you know, neutral oxygen, nitrogen plus, and sulfur plus, which have ionization potentials not too different from hydrogen. So you have to have hot electrons in a essentially partly, mostly neutral zone. Okay, and if you have an optically thick cloud which is shined on by, say, the ionizing spectrum of an O star, this so-called partially ionized zone is a very thin onion skin. Okay, it's the famous Strongham solution. Therefore, these lines are very weak, say, in an O-star powered source. They're very strong in a source which has much more energetic photons that can penetrate deep into this cloud and create this extensive partly ionized zone. So that is a fundamental physical reason why we can use these lines. It's a surrogate to measure, essentially, the shape of the ionizing radiation field. This doesn't sound so difficult. So the key is simply to measure these lines. Okay? Well, you realize that this is not so easy if you look at the actual data. Now, when you talk about Cepheid galaxies, most people are probably familiar with the object in the top, NGC 4151. And indeed, measuring the lines there is fairly trivial. Okay, the lines are very bright compared to the galaxy background. Most of the objects I encounter in the local survey, in fact, have spectra that look like this. There's absolutely nothing wrong with these data, I remind you. In fact, every single wiggle here is a real spectral feature. It's not noise. Okay? But you can see that the emission lines are very, very weak, in most cases completely dominated by underlying galaxy light. So clearly, the ability to measure these lines and play with the line ratios is completely limited by your ability to subtract this background. Okay. I won't say how we did that, except that we did that very carefully, and probably better than it's ever been done before. And we're able to measure extremely weak lines. In fact, the sensitivity level of our survey is roughly a factor of 30 to 50 higher than the best surveys previously done. So, having done this, of course, we can just classify galaxies according to whether they have an AGN spectrum or not an AGN spectrum. And this is the bottom line, okay? The most astounding thing that I'd like to point out is that the fraction of galaxies with apparently AGN-like spectra is extremely high. If you integrate over all Hubble types, this is detection rate versus Hubble type, okay? It's over 40%. 40%, okay? And the detection rate is even higher if you concentrate only on the very early type system, those with prominent bulges. It reaches nearly 75% for, say, SA galaxies. Notice it's not zero for the late type galaxies. It's much lower, but it's not zero. Okay. So this is the first main result from the survey. If I show a little bit more detail, a breakdown of the Hubble types, this is very instructive. You notice that the objects which have non-AGN emission lines, what I call H2 nuclei, those powered by star formation, preferentially occur in the later type galaxies, whereas the AGNs occur in the early type galaxies. And just to mention in passing, there is no huge difference between Linus and Cepheids in this comparison. A clear difference in host galaxy morphology. Now, when I keep saying low luminosity and faint, exactly what do I mean by that? I think most of you probably cannot appreciate that until I show you some numbers. The emission line luminosity, say H alpha, have a range of about few times 10 to the 37 to few times 10 to 40 ergs per second. This is to be starkly contrasted with Markarian Cepheids, which go from 40 to 42, and quasars up by another 2 or 3 orders of magnitude. Okay, the non-stellar continuum, the featureless continuum that we are used to thinking in AGNs, is usually undetectable in the optical from ground-based data because the galaxy is just too bright. But if you go to the Hubble Space Telescope, as I'll show you later, you can measure this non-stellar continuum, and it has a range of about minus 9 to about minus 13. On the low end, this is about the brightness of a single individual star, you realize. Okay? Again, classical Cepheid galaxies have a luminosity function that begin at about minus 18 to about minus 23 arbitrarily, quasars up to minus 30. A very interesting point is also that the host galaxies, of course, just big bright galaxies, the L-star galaxies, which are about minus 21 in blue magnitude. Therefore, the ratio of the nucleus to the host galaxy is a factor of 10 to the minus 4. Okay? This explains why most of these objects, in fact, have gone unnoticed, and you will not find them in any standard AGN catalog that you have on your shelf. You can make this comparison further in the radio regime. Most of these sources I'll describe later, in fact, have tiny radio cores, about a millijansky or so, which for these typical distances corresponds to radio powers as low as 10 to the 18 watts per hertz at 5 gigahertz. This is many, many orders of magnitude lower than typical radio galaxies that the audience is familiar with. Then you show a luminosity function for radio cores in nearby elliptical net zero galaxies, and you can see that it's still climbing at around 2 times 10 to the 18. And if you look at a sample of spirals, as I'll show later, you will push these powers even lower by another factor of 10. Okay? So there's good evidence that these things have tiny little radio cores. So let me summarize this part of the talk before I proceed further. The basic point is that a very large fraction of nearby galaxies appear to show evidence for weak nuclear activity, both in the optical and in the radio. An important point to note is that the dominant fraction of these objects belong to this class of objects, which I'll describe in much more detail in a minute, known as liners. They make up two-thirds of the population. Okay, they outnumber Cepheids 2 to 1. And that they basically account for about a third of all galaxies in the sky. So it's absolutely essential that we understand what these things are, because there is a school of thought that say, well, they are AGNs, and we can go home and be very happy. An equally boisterous group would argue that they have nothing to do with black holes. It's just some interesting stellar phenomena. And we have to absolutely resolve this issue, because this is at the heart of the matter, right? So let me now spend some time describing why this is important. Let's just go back to some basics, okay? This class of objects, liners, was originally recognized by Tim Heckman in 1980 as an important class of mission line objects. And it's recognized on the basis of its optical spectrum as having lower characteristic ionization state than Cepheids. This is most easily seen, for instance, by looking at lines coming from the first three ionization states of oxygen, O1, O2, O3. In Cepheids, such as the object on the top, for instance, O3 is very strong compared to O2 and O1, whereas in the bottom, you can see that the lower ionization states are much stronger relative to O3. So at least observationally, we know how to recognize this. Okay? I should add that most people think that liners and Cepheids are two discrete classes of objects. That is really not the case. There's a continuous range, apparently, in ionization. What then is the reason for us to believe that these things have anything to do with AGNs? Well, it happens that you can explain the emission line spectrum of liners very conveniently by appealing to simple traditional photoionization theory, okay? Which accounts, for instance, for the optical line ratios plotted here in these two-dimensional diagrams for Cepheids, for instance, very nicely. Okay, you can essentially account for them with fairly standard conditions with ionization parameters of about minus 1 to minus 2. The ionization parameter is defined to be essentially the ratio of the ionizing photon density to the density of material at the face of the cloud which is being illuminated. If you, for some reason, just drop this parameter U by, say, a factor of 10 or 100, you can pretty well reproduce the emission line ratios observed in liners. This was a point made in 1983 by Halpern and Steiner and Ferlin and Netzer. So in this context, liners are simply a variant of the Cepheid phenomenon that for whatever reason just happens to have a lower range of ionization parameters. Not a very radical idea. In fact, you can explain the whole range of optical line ratios simply by varying reasonable parameters in this context. Okay? What is the problem with this explanation? The problem is that this is not a unique explanation, because you can produce the emission line spectrum, the optical spectrum of liners, also by other means, okay, that have nothing to do with photoionization. For instance, shocks can also produce a very liner-like spectrum. Optical observers would be familiar with this, because if you take a spectrum of a supernova remnant in the galaxy, it has, in fact, a very liner-like spectrum. Okay, And we know that the central regions of galaxies have highly turbulent and certainly supersonic motions, so shocks probably come in play at some level. If you take a spectrum of a cooling flow, say in the center of a giant CD galaxy or even isolated big galaxy, the spectra also look remarkably liner-like. And I told you that the host galaxies tend to be pretty big objects, okay? So it's not crazy to think that some local cooling flows may be going on. And finally, you can even produce line ratios of this type by appealing to very extreme H2 region models, having really hot stars in very unusual conditions. And all these things have been advanced. And the bottom line is, for the last 15 to 20 years, this is where the subject has stood. Okay, we don't know. I mean, you know, simply these objects appear to be a heterogeneous class. And the true challenge is, of course, to try to find a way to break this horrible degeneracy. Okay. What I'm going to argue now is for the first hypothesis, that most liners really are powered by accretion into black hole. And these are the pieces of evidence I'm going to present in order. I'm going to argue that the host galaxy properties of Seyfert and liners are essentially identical. They have black hole masses detected as frequently as Seyfert's. We observe a broad line region both in the direct light and in polarized light. And a multi-wavelength evidence both from morphology and from spectra to indicate it's very likely to be a non-stellar source, and also that the overall spectral energy distribution is consistent with accretion into a compact object. So let me go over these in a bit more detail. I've already shown you the evidence based on the host galaxy morphology, so let me simply reinforce this with the absolute luminosity or masses of the galaxies. Once again, Linus and Seyfert have essentially same distributions in host galaxy luminosities, both a brighter state than the star-forming galaxies. Doug has already shown you the dynamical evidence for black holes. This is my own version of this plot with a little bit more data because I'm a little less careful perhaps in rejecting some of the cases. Nonetheless, this is the famous black hole mass versus bulge luminosity diagram. And identified here in blue are the objects that have an optical classification of liners. So clearly there are liners with massive black holes. So to the extreme skeptics who say that no liners can be AGNs, I say take this, okay? So at least that's very firm evidence. We know that one of the distinguishing features of Seyfert 1 galaxies and quasars, of course, they have these whoppingly broad lines, right? These famous broad line regions, you know, thousands of kilometers per second. Can you identify a similar kinematic feature in liners, okay? And that was one of the explicit goals of the Palomar survey. We wanted data that's good enough to be able to identify such broad lines, even if they're extremely weak. Okay. We've done a very careful analysis of the line profiles and removing starlight and all of that. And basically outlined here in red are the weak little broad line to the H-alpha line that we discovered. In total, about 25 to 30% of the entire AGN sample showed this broad feature. Okay. 46 objects we detected in the entire survey. The interesting thing is that half of these 46 objects are technically liners, according to the narrow line definition of what a liner is. So clearly, liners come in two flavors, just like Seyfert's do. Okay? Some have a visible broad line regions, and some either don't have it visible or don't have one at all. Okay? So by analogy with the standard nomenclature for Seyfert's, of course, there appears to be liner ones and liner twos. Well, that was based on one line. Maybe you're skeptical. There may be some special way of producing a broad H-alpha line without producing all the other lines that one typically sees in broad line AGNs. You can go to the HST to look at the other lines. For instance, this is M81 FOS spectra. These are data pretty hard to come by because these are quite faint, okay? But the point here is that you see the standard broad lines. They have widths of several thousand, even 10,000 kilometers per second, featureless continuum, the whole nine yards, okay? The line ratios for the aficionados, you notice, are completely weird. They're not at all like you see in Seyfert. That's because it's not a Seyfert. The ionization conditions are very different. But the kinematic signatures are unmistakable, okay? There is yet another example, NGC 4579, which is very similar to M81 in many respects. This is a work that was part of Aaron Barth's PhD thesis. So clearly, the broad line region is detected in more than just one line. There's another class of AGNs that was mentioned briefly by Ski. these so-called double peak broad line objects, which typically in about 10% of all radio loud AGNs, they have not only broad lines but double peak broad lines. A remarkable thing is nearly all of these things have narrow line ratios that are very liner-like. Okay, so they may be taken as examples of liners, further example of liners with broad line region. These specific examples, of course, are very encouraging, but of course, it doesn't get to the heart of the matter. We're not interested in just a few examples. We want to know statistically, for the entire population, what fraction of them have a broad line region. And to do this, you have to return to the Palomar survey and think a little bit more at what this means. Okay? I already told you that we clearly see liner ones and liner twos. The liner ones account for something like 20-25% of the overall liner population. So these are not in doubt. I think these are really bona fide AGNs. Okay? The real question is, what fraction of the remainder, the majority, the liner twos, what fraction of the liner twos really are part of the same phenomenon? Well, this is a bit hand-wavy, but by analogy with the Seyfert twos population, which are thought to have obscured broad line regions, surely some fraction of the liner twos must also obey this, okay? And just for the moment, for the sake of argument, that the ratio of liner 2s to 1s is approximately the same as the ratio of Seyfert 2s to 1s, which by number is 1.6 to 1 in the Palomar survey, then one would conclude that about 40-65, about half 60% of all the liners may in fact truly be AGNs, okay? You understand, of course, that these statistics based on detection of broad H-alpha emission are only strictly lower limits, because if there were fainter lines yet, we just simply could not detect it with our starlight subtraction and our current sensitivity. There's an effort to improve that with STIS, where we will use a very small aperture in the nucleus and effectively increase the sensitivity by about a factor of 50 to try to get a better handle on the true detection rate. Okay, well that was kind of hand-wavy, because I said, you know, suppose essentially that liners obey the unified model that is well accepted for Seyfert galaxies. What evidence do you have at all that that is remotely true? Okay, what evidence is there that there is an obscure broad line region? Well, doing the same sort of test by spectral polarimetry or whatever is extremely difficult for these faint objects, right? But you can do so if you use a very large telescope. Aaron Barth undertook this challenge with the Keck telescope, 10-meter telescope, doing spectral polarimetry of NGC 1052, which is considered to be a prototypical liner, which I previously claimed that in direct light there was weak evidence for a broad line, but this broad line is unmistakable in polarized spectrum. Okay, so you might call this a liner analog, a low ionization analog of NGC 1052 or something like, I'm sorry, 1068. And that's not the only object. Aaron has a bunch of these. Here's another one, NGC 315. Same story. In polarized light, you see a broad line region popping up. Okay. Again, it's very hard to push these observations to a statistically meaningful sample. Okay. But at least this is encouraging, and it's telling us that our picture is probably not horribly wrong. Now I'm going to switch gears and talk a bit about the morphological information. What should you expect to see if these objects truly have an AGN-like nucleus? Again, by analogy with the bright objects, you might expect to see a really compact point-like source, essentially all wavelengths. What is the evidence that this is true? In the optical, it's essentially impossible to do this from the ground. Okay? The galaxy, again, is 10,000 times brighter than the nucleus. It's absolutely impossible to find any point-like nucleus based on even the best-seeing images from the ground. To do so, you have to use HST, and I've been pursuing this pretty systematically by using the WIFPIC2 camera and taking pictures of nearby galaxies that are classified as liners or Seyferts. You can see a bewildering assortment of morphologies. Here's a bunch of liners. To remind you that the scale here is 1 kiloparsec, and the tick mark is roughly 5 arc seconds. Okay. There's a very rich amount of information which I don't have time to even touch upon. The goal is to try to measure the central point. Okay? You might think that is very trivial. In fact, it is not trivial, because the central light distribution of most spiral galaxies is very, very peaky. Okay? So measuring an excess point source above and beyond a peaky underlying stellar distribution is actually a non-trivial process, but I think we figure out a way to do that by modeling the underlying bulge, which is not at all the Vaucouleurs profile, by the way, very carefully, and then put limits or quantify the excess above that. And you can see extremely faint, intrinsically faint nuclei. Okay. I don't have any firm numbers on overall statistics, except to say that this kind of stuff is very common. We will refine that statement in time. This stuff is much, much easier if you go to shorter wavelengths. If you go to UV, the entire host galaxy disappears. That's beautiful because the bulge is old stars, okay? And if there's a point-like nucleus, that is essentially the only thing that remains in the image. And we've done a number of surveys, three to date, to quantify this using HST UV images. And the bottom line is that we see a compact UV source in about a quarter of the cases. 25% of the liners, we see a compact UV source. This is a very ambiguous result, and we don't really understand what it means. Does it mean that only 25% of liners have an ionizing point-like continuum? Or does it instead mean that 75% of liners are obscured by dust? Because you don't need a lot of dust to extinguish a little weak source, especially since the filter was centered essentially 2200 angstroms. Okay. There is some evidence to suggest that the dust is the explanation, because there is a clear dependence of the detection of UV source versus the inclination of the host galaxy. All the ones that are detected are essentially face-on. If you kind of correct that, the true detection rate may be something like 60%, which is a very interesting number, because that's essentially the fraction of the liner population that I argued earlier that may be true AGNs. Okay? You can go to the X-rays. To do so, you need something like HRI. It has 5 arc second resolution, which is not great, but it's the best thing you have at the moment. We systematically going through the archive and some of our own pointed observations, and indeed, we see a compact X-ray source in many, many cases. Okay, in fact, in most cases, majority of the cases, centered roughly at the position of the optical nucleus. They typically have luminosities of a few times 10 to the 40 ergs per second. These are not trivial observations to make, by the way. To detect something this faint, you need several tens of kiloseconds of observations, and TACs are not willing to give that much time to observe, in their opinion, boring galaxies. I think pushing this we're trying to do as much as we can with existing data. These sort of observations are going to be much improved in a few months, hopefully, when AXSAF goes up, because there's a GTO program that I'm involved in where we're going to essentially take snapshots of tens of such objects, and detecting point sources even 100 times fainter would be fairly trivial. In the meantime, you can make some progress understanding the origin of the X-rays by looking at the spectrum. Okay? You can do so very painstakingly with ASCA, even for these faint sources. Here's one example, NGC 4639. I show it because it's, in fact, fairly representative of these class of objects in general. The X-ray broadband X-ray spectrum from about 1 to 10 kV, say, is not too different than a bright Seyfert. Okay, it's well modeled by a single absorbed power law with a photon index, which is roughly about 1.7, 1.8, which is what Paul Nondra and others see for other Seyfert galaxies. They're not heavily absorbed. Okay, somewhat in excess of galactic, but there's no huge columns. Again, they have hard X-ray luminosities about 10 to the 40 ergs per second. And the evidence for an RNK line at 6.5 kV is ambiguous. In most cases, this is what we see. We see some evidence for a positive residual, but simply not enough photons to tell. Okay. One thing that distinguishes them from high luminosity AGNs is that these things do not appear to be rapidly variable on short timescales. Okay, there's no significant variability on short timescales, and certainly not at the level of NGC 4051 for the X-ray pundits. And these things should be even more variable than NGC 4051 because they're much fainter. They don't seem to be rapidly varying in hard X-rays. You can beat down the statistics a little bit if you combined many of these observations and created a composite spectrum, put some tighter limits on the existence of the RNK alpha line. In most cases, you simply do not see it. Okay. And the upper limits at the moment hover around 140 electron volts or so. This may be a very important clue that say, missions like XMM should pin down, do these things have RNK alpha lines or not? And if they don't, it may be telling us interesting tidbits about the nature of the accretion flow. Maybe it doesn't have a thick disk, and maybe it's an ADAF and whatnot. Okay. Finally, to complete the grand tour of the electromagnetic spectrum, it turns out you can learn quite a bit by going to the radio wavelengths using something like the VLA. I've been systematically pursuing this with the A array at the VLA, because it turns out that at X band in an A array, you can achieve essentially a resolution which is only a factor of 2 worse than the HST, which is pretty good, okay? And what I find, again, the analysis is still being done, so the number is not conclusive, but in general, a very general statement I can make is, at 6 centimeters at least, I almost always see a compact source. Okay? I almost always see a compact source, it's essentially unresolved, except in a few cases. Interestingly, there's usually just one. You might expect a cluster of distributed sources if it were, you know, say a starburst region, okay? And it's almost always exactly coincident with the optical nucleus of the galaxy. But they're very faint, they're only about a millijansky or a couple millijanskys. At X-band, the source is a bit fainter, usually, which means the spectrum is characteristically steep, okay? Contrary to what Heckman claimed a number of years ago, these things are actually fairly steep, not inconsistent with optically thin synchrotron emission. About a quarter of the cases actually have flat or inverted spectrum. I also have a parallel survey going on at 2 centimeters, and about a quarter of the cases have inverted spectra. And the brightest of these, we've attacked them with a VLBA, which can achieve much higher angle resolutions in order to set meaningful limits on the brightness temperatures. And typically, the kind of flux densities we detect at 5 gigahertz are a few millijansky in 1 milliarc second. That translates to brightness temperature limit of excess of 10 to the 8 degrees Kelvin, okay. Which is very interesting because that's very likely a non-thermal source. Okay, there are evidence for little jets and all sorts of other things I don't have time to go into. So that's the grand tour of the multi-wavelength observations. I think they're pointing us in the direction that a good fraction of these things really associate with active nuclei, even if they're not the familiar sort. What can you learn if you put all of these data together? Okay. Let me remind you what you can learn for high luminosity AGNs. Of course, the multi-wavelength SCD has imprinted a lot of very important information about the physics of the accretion process, and Ski and Tanucci already reviewed this, so I won't belabor the point, except to mention that most high luminosity AGNs can be fairly well characterized by a standard shape in energy space, which is roughly flat with a few notable deviations, the most famous of which is the so-called Big Blue Bump, which for many people is thought to be the signature of thermal emission from an optically thick, geometrically thin accretion disk, although we've heard problems with that particular interpretation that Ski mentioned. Nonetheless, this is what usually high luminosity AGNs look like. Okay, of course, there's a famous dichotomy of radio louds and radio quiets. What I wanted to do is to compile data of the requisite quality to construct a similar diagram to try to understand the physics of these low luminosity sources. And you can do so very painstakingly because not only do you need very high sensitivity to detect faint sources, you need really, really high resolution at all wavelengths so you can suppress the contamination from the background. So here are some examples of data. It's a very busy plot, so why don't you just focus on the bottom panel. The two points I want to make are the following. Most of the sources I've looked at have a characteristic shape. The SCDs have a very distinctive shape. In that shape, the second point is that shape is different than the previous diagram I just showed you for high luminosity sources. What is the characteristic shape? Usually the radio shows a flat or inverted spectrum, probably a self-absorbed synchrotron emission. There is essentially no data in the millimeter, submillimeter, and far infrared. IRAS is useless for this, so we don't know what happens here. We don't really know what happens at near infrared at the moment. These are ground-based measurements, which need to be updated with NICMOS observations, which I have at hand, but I haven't done so. But roughly from the mid-infrared to the UV, it seems to be a very steeply declining spectrum. The 10 micron point is probably not too bad because normal stellar populations don't shine much at 10 microns. There could be reprocessed dust. Who knows? We'll see. CERTIF may help with this. In any event, seems to be a pretty steeply falling spectrum out to the UV, and then things climb back up again in the X-rays. Okay. Some of these objects have ASCA observations, which have been confirmed with HRI that indeed most of the luminosity comes from a point and not from some distributed source. So this is a very characteristic spectrum. Okay, I've done this exercise for a total of 7 objects for which I have data of this quality, but also very importantly for which I have an estimate of the dynamical central mass from the observations that Doug described, for instance, because I'm interested in using these data to model the accretion flow. And now I show essentially all 7 objects normalized in the same graph. I normalized them at 1 keV, and I superpose the two standard SEDs for radio loud and radio quiet, high luminosity AGNs, which, by the way, I should reference Martin Elvis and his group, which produced these data. It's not the Sanders version, but the Elvis et al. Version, 1994. And there are several very striking things you immediately see. Okay. The most striking is that the big blue bump, whatever its origin, is not there. There's no big blue bump. There's a big blue hole. Okay. And I can argue, which I won't, but you can ask me later, I don't think this is due to dusk obscuration. I think this is an intrinsic feature. Okay. This leads, of course, this explains the very steep optical UV slope. It also explains an observation that was pointed out by Rich Machowski, actually, in the Madrid conference a number of years ago, that the X-rays are energetically quite important relative to the UV. In X-ray terminology, alpha OX, which typically is 1.2 to 1.4, by the way, this is a spectral index between 2000 and 2 keV, in these objects, they have an average value of about 0.8. So these things are quite X-ray dominant. Okay? There's a possible maximum somewhere in the infrared. Exactly where and what its strength is not well defined at the moment, so I won't put too much weight on that. The radio spectrum, again, is flat or inverted, but a very interesting thing is that notice how bright the X-rays are, I'm sorry, that the radio is compared to the rest of the spectrum. These things are quite radio loud, okay? Despite the fact that half of this sample are bulges of spiral galaxies. The bolometric luminosities, by integrating these curves, are something like 10 to the 40, 10 to the 41 Hertz per second, and the respective Eddington ratios are extremely tiny. They're as low as 10 to the minus 6, and the highest value is about 10 to the minus 3. Now, it's difficult to prove this, but I think that these low Eddington ratios suggest that the radiative efficiency of these accreting systems is extremely low. It's highly unlikely to be 10%. Okay. To generate 10 to the 40 ERCs per second, for instance, will require an M dot of about 10 to the minus 7 solar masses per year. It's just very hard to imagine how that can be if these black holes are sitting on top of this really, really cuspy distribution of stars. If nothing else, they're losing mass, okay? They're mass-losing stars. And even some fraction of that were to dribble in, not to mention accretion flows and whatnot. At this rate of efficiency times m dot c squared, you would get much, much more luminosity than you observe. Okay? The classical problem that was, in fact, pointed long ago in the context of ellipticals by Andy Fabian and Claude Canizares, which is now, in fact, present in all of these nearby sources. I don't wish to go into the details because we haven't really fleshed out the technical details, but I'm working with Ramesh Narayan, Tiziana DiMatteo, to try to model this characteristic shape and these low luminosities in the context of advection-dominated accretion flow models. And the only thing I wish to say is that they're promising, okay? They're very promising, although there's some details we haven't quite understood yet that we're trying to work out. I think that's a possible solution to these observations. In any event, the observations are not disputed. There are two things you have to remember. One is the distinctly peculiar shape of the SEDs, which I maintain are intrinsic, and secondly, that the Eddington ratios are low. That is a given fact. Okay. Let me summarize the talk, and then I'll speculate a bit about what we should do in the future. I try to show you that low-level nuclear activity appears to be ubiquitous in nearby galaxies, especially the big galaxies that have a bulge component. I've shown you that the largest population of these AGN candidates belong to this mysterious class of objects known as liners, and I've argued quite extensively that most of these liners are likely to be AGNs. One can draw from this the following conclusion, or at least a statement, that most, perhaps all, bulge systems evidently contain massive black holes, and this is in accord with the kinematic evidence that Doug Richstone talked about. AGNs span a very enormous range in intrinsic luminosity, about 8 orders of magnitude, and a large range in ionization parameter, at least a factor of 1,000. Okay? They evidently have a very large range in Eddington ratios, from roughly unity for the really high luminosity systems to about a millionth of that. The SEDs change dramatically with luminosity. For the very low luminosity objects I've talked about, they're clearly different from the high luminosity objects. And I've argued, without showing you much proof, that we think that both the low volumetric luminosities and the peculiar shape of the SEDs is likely a consequence of very low accretion rates that these black holes are experiencing, perhaps in an advection-dominated mode. One thing I didn't really discuss, which I'll just bring up here, is that this peculiar SED shape, okay, where the UV is suppressed compared to X-rays, offers a very natural explanation of why these objects have a liner-like spectrum to begin with. Do you remember the initial diagram I showed you to explain the origin of the optical lines, right? The reason that the low ionization lines are so strong in AGNs is because you have a lot of X-rays compared to O-stars. Well, this is even a more extreme case. If you de-emphasize the big UV bump and emphasize the X-rays, you're essentially really enhancing the so-called partially ionized zone, and that the effect of that is to create a much stronger low ionization lines, and therefore more liner-like spectrum. The other point is that because the radio is so dominant, heating from the hot electrons also contribute to enhancing the low ionization lines. Okay. We're working on that with a student more quantitatively, but I think that goes a long way towards explaining why we're surrounded by liners in the local universe. I think that's a likely explanation. And as I mentioned, this implies, of course, that most of these massive black holes, which reside in almost all galaxies, spend most of the time in a quiescent state. Let me now remark on a few open questions, which I hope the various workshops, topical sessions will touch upon. These, I think, are some of the more interesting questions in my mind, which at least I like to see discussed. If every galaxy, at least those with the bulge, has a massive black hole, this, to me, is a really astounding statement, right? It's a statement that we could not have made a few years ago. What does that mean? That means that a massive black hole is an integral component of galactic structure. I think that's an astounding statement. Okay, massive black holes are not the freaks of nature that occur in 1% of galaxies that make up the quasars, and they produce these jets and things that make observers go out and observe them. They're an integral component of galactic structure. So people who build galaxies, people who evolve galaxies, somehow they cannot neglect that fact. Okay, they have to somehow naturally account for that, have a model to explain that. Okay, so the time evolution of the black hole mass, the accretion rate onto the black hole, are very important issues. And of course, as these things change, so do the spectral properties of AGNs. We have no reason to believe that the relative fractions of Seyfert's liners, ones and twos, and whatever that we see locally, is it all the same at redshift of 1 or 2 or 3 or 5? Okay, so. Observers would have a field day trying to sort this out, but clearly the spectral properties of AGNs would change with time. And a very fundamental question is, what is the evolution of the luminosity function of AGNs? We really don't know beyond the brightest quasars. Brian Boyle and others have done a bang-up job on that. We know a little bit about the local AGNs, but that's a large gap in knowledge between the highest redshift universe and the brightest objects in the lowest redshift universe and the lowest. We really don't know in between. And why do we care? We care because at least other people should care. People who think about galaxy evolution should care. Because I think, and as Andy has alluded to, these objects may not be negligible contributors to the overall energy density of the universe. After all, if they are in every galaxy, they can light up anywhere from zero, which is what we have locally, to maximally, which is what we have at hybrid shift quasars, and what is it in between, okay? So I'd like to know is what is the contribution of non-stellar radiation to the total energy density as a function of time? Now, this kind of graph is thrown around a lot in these days in extragalactic talks, so-called Madaw diagram, which shows essentially the star formation history rate as a function of redshift, and it's usually assumed that this is due to stars. Okay? And in some cases, there is evidence of that. In the best text spectra, you do see stellar absorption features. But most of this diagram is composed of data that have one emission line or no emission line whatsoever, some UV luminosity density. I challenge the observers who put this diagram up to show me that this is due to stars. Okay. I'm sure most of it is, probably in the end, but we really have to be careful. Okay. So I think it has broad implications for the general extragalactic community who worry about diagrams such as this. Now let me just end by saying what are some of the ongoing and future programs that we should undertake. I already alluded to the STIS program that we're already currently doing. We're doing a distance-limited survey of emission-line galaxies selected from the Palomar sample using a much smaller slit that should nail down and refine the optical numbers. Okay? We're doing a similar survey with ACES, an AXAF, which has half arc-second resolution. That's going to tell us which galaxies have a point-like hard X-ray source, a very important study. I'm continuing all these multi-wavelength programs, of course. And of course, there's the kinematic searches of black holes with STIS that Doug has discussed, which I'm also involved in. And combining these multi-wavelength data, which allows you to construct SCDs and black hole mass measurements, one should model the SCDs seriously with models like ADAF or whatnot. I've undertaken the challenge that I think Mitch alluded to of trying to find these nuclear flares due to stellar disruptions by massive black holes. To do so, one needs, in fact, something like 100,000 galaxies, because the predicted rates are very uncertain. Okay, there are like 50 theoretical papers and no observations. Okay, but to do this, you need to monitor about 100,000 galaxies, which goes hand in hand with a definitive low redshift supernova search. And you can do these days with a very large aerial CCDs that cover, say, a square degree. And a good CCD that has good image quality, you can do the image subtraction. And this program has already begun. Observations have been taken, and I'm going there again in 3 weeks to do this again. And finally, I think with the advent of very large aperture optical telescopes, people taking deeper and deeper optical spectra of galaxies, this question of what is the spectral evolution of galaxies and determination of luminosity function, I think should be focused on in the future. Okay, thank you very much. Yes, I'm aware of those observations. Yeah.
And one of them was followed up and did show massive spectrum emission, and one showed absolutely nothing. Mm-hmm. So that's possible if there's any suspicion. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then it shows, quite quickly, the X-ray is a the easiest way to see the activity of the photon volumetric process. This, of course, is confirmed beautifully to Hoffinger's all these survey work, with the vast majority of objects
I completely agree. I think, in fact, one of the most exciting things I think that will come in the next couple of years would be Keck follow-up of the AXAF deep field center on the HDF, for instance. Okay, be able to take good spectra of the faint X-ray sources and get their redshifts.
By the way, the AXAF can see absolute magnitude
I'd like to ask a couple of related questions about the prospects of some steward liners, your liner two. One is, you had mentioned that you had good reason to believe that the absence of UV, your typical liner, was not due to extinction.
Here.
And the second related question, what the prospects are for 10 micron imaging to see if there are infrared points at the entrance of the mirror glass.
Several of the objects that went into my SCD constructions, those had a visible broadline region. Okay, so they probably do not substantially absorbed. The second point is that the liner twos also in that diagram do not show systematically different SCDs compared to the liner ones. Okay, so if they were heavily absorbed by dust, one might expect them to be much more reddened than the liner ones. That does not seem to be the case. I don't think that the majority of the liner twos really have obscured broadline regions. In the same way, I don't think that the majority of CFIT2s, or all CFIT2s, have obscured broadline. At least I don't think the evidence is there to conclusively show that. The reason I don't think it's a dust absorption is that if it were, okay, you can always argue that it is. You can say somehow the high luminosity sources are less obscured than the low luminosity sources. There's no line of evidence to show that based on line ratios and whatnot, that the low luminosity sources are systematically more reddened than the high luminosity sources. And secondly, the second thing you can appeal to is that, well, they simply have very different extinction curves. Okay, you can always play that game, that somehow the low luminosity sources, say, do not have, you know, a 2200 angstrom blue bump or something like that. And that has been argued that could be plausible in AGNs because, you know, the strong radiation field destroys the graphite grains or whatnot. But that should exactly happen for the other class of objects. That should happen for the high luminosity AGNs, not the low luminosity AGNs. So it goes in the wrong sense. So one can always appeal to such ad hoc arguments, but I don't think. Yes, it's possible to get roughly sub-arcsecond, not much less than one, but with the best available mid-infrared arrays, say Merlin or something, which is available, say, on 200-inch. And I have programs in progress to try to do that. So the best of my knowledge at the moment, before NGST, you can only do roughly maybe half an arcsecond resolution, which would be a factor of 10 improvement compared to what I've shown you here. Which are usually based on bolometer measurements that have few arcsecond apertures. So that will be improved upon in the next few months.
During your talk, I was expecting that after several minutes you begin to speak about our galaxy as about LIDAR. But you were silent. I don't know why. And our galaxy also has, first, if we would observe our galaxy with ASCA, we would see luminosity of the order of maybe two times than about 39 Hz per second. This is 26 X-ray sources which we are observing in the center of what, in the central kiloparsec of our galaxy. We will see immediately in our galaxy these weakly ionized regions like Neon 2 region. Everybody knows many years they are observed in the central part of our galaxy, but no any relation to the central, to the real activity of black hole. Now we know that there is ultraviolet, huge ultraviolet luminosity due to these seven stars which are there, which were detected by Jensen, and so on. Many, many things, and there is non-thermal radio source, which is obviously weaker than majority of your liners are showing, but we know that central 100 per second of our galaxy is very bright in non-thermal. You thought, I believe, about this. What is your opinion? If we would observe our galaxy from a side, would we consider also it as a liner or not?
I think it would fall below the detection limit of the sources that I'm talking about, because the no, but quite a bit more, because I think the bolometric luminosity is like 3 times 10 to the 37 ergs or something like that?
Actually, he's talking about a bigger area.
Okay.
So he is, did he speak about ASTA data?
That's right.
Okay.
Because with ASTA data, it would be immediately...
So first of all, I don't know what kind of optical classification it would have, because we don't have such information for the galactic center. But it's true that if we look at the galactic center, we have a bewildering array of sources that have nothing to do with the nucleus, which would contribute to the integrated light at the kind of resolutions that we're talking about. The point I'm trying to make is simply that I'm subjecting the Liner class to the same standards that people apply for Cepheid galaxies. What right do we have to believe that most Cepheid galaxies are powered by black holes? Okay, most of them we don't have black hole mass measurements. Many of them we don't have Brawline regions. Okay, I mean, somebody could take me up on that, but what right do we have that every weak Cepheid 2 galaxy, so-called Cepheid 2 galaxy, is really powered by black holes? So this is a much more complicated issue, of course. I'm only subjecting the Liner class to the same typical criteria that people subject to well-known AGNs and say that they have essentially similar observed properties. But on scales of parsecs, well, I don't know.
No, but situation in our galaxy is even worse, because we all believe now in the results from Gess and Gensel group that there is black hole, and this is only one thing, that your data show in reality upper limits sometimes for the model. Maybe not every thing, not every point is in reality connected with black hole. That's only what I wanted to say.
I think
there is obviously black hole in our galaxy and maybe in majority of planets.
Probably the single best future observation, in fact, will be this survey with AXAF that I mentioned, which has half an arc second resolution, which for typical distances here is roughly about 30, 50 parsecs. Okay, we observe a single point source exactly on the optical nucleus, and maybe with deeper observations we can observe variability, or maybe with XMM we can take a spectrum. Okay, so that will probably be the single cleanest test. But I agree. If you any extragalactic observer looked at the galactic center, they probably would quit astronomy. They're not varying like blazars. There's little evidence for boosted jets, although there's weak evidence for jets of some nature in the highest VLBI maps. That's interesting. But okay. My I know the answer to that. They can all be beamed at you, right? It's a third of all galaxies in the sky. The masses come from dynamical measurements of stars, the same that Doug Richstone talked about. These are not based on, say, Brawline region kinematics or anything like that.
Maybe the dynamical, because the luminosity, the continuum luminosity of the compact source is so small, maybe, most broadly actually, the kinematic star sample in much larger region than the region that actually is related to the nuclear
core. There are two objects I didn't throw in that diagram which would also fit with the pattern. That is the galactic center, which has been modeled extensively by Narayan and company, and 4258, which is modeled by Jean-Pierre Lasota and others. And there's no doubt that the mass the mass determination is not dominated by stars. But it's true, most of the HST measurements, you could still allow for some contamination from.
Even if the measure was in moderate HST, the resolution is not small enough to be sure that you are sampling a very small region. So sure.
Mazes, of course the mazes are.
Let me move on to another question. Maybe it is a good topic for discussion, Andrzej.
You mentioned that in X-rays, those objects, low luminosity agents, look really very similar to regular AGNs with this photon indices of K1.8. But then you said that they can be modeled by advection models. And, you know, normally advection models predict that if you go down to luminosity, there is a pretty strong spectral resolution, and in fact, a Bernstrahlung component dominates at low luminosities. While this, it seems basically virtually no evolution in the slope. And you commented that you said that you have a good model. What is the radiative process that produces X-rays?
Well, in the ADAP models, it comes from Bremsstrahlung and also from inverse content scattering. I think my feeling is that such a small energy range, you know, the Asker energy range, it's difficult to really test whether the exact shape of the X-ray spectrum is consistent or not consistent with combination of those two X-ray mechanisms.
So Bremsstrahlung is much harder, certainly.
Yeah, well, but there is all.
It's very high temperature. It's very high temperature. Plasma temperature.
Okay, we have one more question from Marek and then from Steve.
Yes, there is. Not from many sources, but then not too many sources have been monitored. The ones that have been monitored, in fact, show. I'm trying to find a view graph to illustrate that. This is the object with the most data, which is a nucleus of M81. And the reason it has so much data is that fortuitously, supernova 93J exploded. So both the nucleus and the supernova was in the same primary beam, both in England and in the VLA. And you can see two types of variability. Extremely rapid variability at short wavelengths. These are less than a day, intraday variability. And also longer timescale blobs, which can be traced at more than one frequency. It's consistent with ejection of relativistic blobs. In fact, VLBI pictures taken roughly during the same epoch, in fact, shows a little blob being created. this is not too different than, say, observations of big radio galaxies, actually. In the case of the galactic center, it also varies in the radio. In fact, Aaron Barth has obtained data for M81 and several others. In the case of M81 specifically, there is no evidence for additional broad line in scattered light. Yes, this business of the broad lines not varying very rapidly is one clear departure from the high luminosity sources. But I think it's a signal that the structure of the accretion disk and the things around it fundamentally breaking down. I mean, it doesn't scale exactly with the high luminosity sources. Maybe indication that, you know, the accretion flow is switching from something like the standard thing to something which is advective. I don't know what the variability characteristics one should expect from the ADAP model, but it's telling you that it's not just a simple scale-down version of the high luminosity objects. In M81, it's full width zero intensity, 10,000 kilometers per second. And it's observed in his broad iron 2 emission, the whole suite. If you can show me a star that looks like that, I would be very excited. maybe that's a plausible thing to explore, but you do see it in more than one line, right? Yeah.
Yeah, I might suggest we address the further questions of the drink.